wrong set of goals. You know, we have at the same time a shift of everything that the country had been founded on, everything that had produced the wealth in the country, everything that then redistributes the wealth. So let me re-enter the picture at this sad juncture in American history and try to rectify the situation. Several things happened to radically change the nature of charity in America over the course of the 20th century. One was a shift in the proper understanding of what government was supposed to be doing, as opposed to the individual, in caring for those in need. With the advent of the New Deal and later the Great Society, the government became the source of assistance and no longer the individual in the community. And even those who were working through foundations now had the big foundation model, which was not in substance very much different than the big government model because of its ideological bent. Charles Murray writes in his book, In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government, communities exist because they have a reason to exist, some core of functions around which the affiliations that constitute a vital community can form and grow. When the government takes away a core function, it depletes not only a source of vitality pertaining to that particular function, but also the vitality of a much larger family of responses. You see, what's taken place here is that the locus of responsibility for one's neighbors has shifted from the individual, from the community, essentially to government. And insofar as it was being fulfilled there, there was no moral sense of obligation on the part of the individuals. It was being handled elsewhere. When charity was shifted from the grassroots private sector to the government, America destroyed its local training grounds of civic virtue. The things that de Tocqueville saw worked very well. Not only is the government incapable of efficiently meeting the needs of the poor, the attempt has atrophied the soul of the individuals that gave this nation its spiritual and moral vitality. I would suggest that the war on poverty became the war on the poor because it destroyed the ability of the poor to care for themselves. That much I think many of us at least here would agree on. But what also is seldom discussed is that it atrophied the hearts of the Americans who could have helped individually and were in the process of losing the capacity for civic virtue that Tocqueville had admired. To the extent that the large charitable foundations have departed from their original mission of building civic capacity in individuals, the things that Bert talked about, universities, libraries, and private solutions, they have also atrophied hearts in America. The one-to-one relational bridges that characterized charity in the early phase of America's history were crucial in building character in both the giver and the receiver. You see, this is a two-way relationship. And to the extent that the individuals and the foundations have realized this, some of them are now focusing on civic renewal at the neighborhood level. We are beginning to experience a renaissance of charity and compassion of a different sort. There's a new breed of social entrepreneur in America whose intellectual and moral roots go back to those roots at the time of the founding and whose later flowering Tocqueville admired. These social entrepreneurs understand that in order to bring about lasting change for the better, both material and spiritual needs need to be addressed. They understand that giving a hand up rather than a handout respects the dignity of the individual and also empowers people to lead a productive life. These people also realize that inculcating character is a very important part of building social capital. And the personal relationships are the best bridges to shaping character. They've also discovered that people who live in the same city or the same neighborhood as those they serve are more likely to do an effective job at knowing the genuine needs of their neighbors. They understand that true compassion means to suffer with, compati, and that the personal relationships between the giver and the receiver change lives in both directions. These are the modern manifestations of the original concept of charity as practiced by our forefathers. There are foundations that have focused their resources on renewing civic vigor, the Templeton Foundation, the Bradley Foundation, there are many. They have empowered a host of social entrepreneurs around the country now who are doing the difficult work of scooping up broken and battered human beings and loving them into wholeness. The National Center for Neighborhood Enterprise in Washington is headed by Robert Woodson. He's embarked on a national search to identify essentially grassroots community renewers, many of them minorities, many of them incredibly poor, living on a shoestring budget and doing a phenomenal job at breathing life into the community, but from the grassroots up. Now, these are the kinds of groups that would not know how to apply or would never receive a grant from a major foundation. However, they are potent agents of civic renewal, and they are working in this American tradition of thriving voluntary associations. These are the kinds of groups that I work with at the Center for Renewal, and they are worthy of our support. We're experiencing a kind of a paradigm shift in the inner cities of America. There is a small but growing coalition that spans racial divides, denominational lines, and also political affiliations. Some political liberals are reconsidering the welfare model because it is simply proven ineffective. Some blacks who look to the government to renew their communities are fed up with waiting and are saying, we will do it ourselves. Some conservatives, myself included, have reached a point where we say, we've done a very good job of saying what the government should not do, but we have not done a good job as a movement in rolling up our sleeves and embracing those responsibilities of helping the poor ourselves. Who is then to do it, if not we? I'm arguing for our responsibility in the private sector. What we need is a change of heart, not a change of policy. And all of these different factions, various minorities, people in the inner cities today, and others who have come up with a lot of questions, are now joining forces in this, what I call the third sector. And they are joining forces around the private, voluntary, faith-based groups that all of these parties acknowledge serve the best interests of Anglos and Latinos, blacks and whites, in a shared purpose that transcends both politics and race. Faith-based social entrepreneurs are on the front lines renewing our communities from the inside out, one life at a time. They approach social problems with the mindset of an entrepreneur. They're results-driven, innovative, cost-effective. They provide both material and spiritual renewal, and they equip people to leave dependency through empowerment. There are any number of effective groups. I have a paper that's out on the tables out there that essentially presents the case for faith-based social entrepreneurs that I prepared for the Templeton Foundation a few weeks ago. There's a short digest in there of the effectiveness of Teen Challenge, for example, and Victory Fellowship, two reasonably well-known groups that are working with minority communities, primarily with drug addiction, and are producing something like between a 60 and a 70 or even higher success rate in leaving drugs and alcohol once and for all, but by empowering people to lead a changed life. One of the hottest approaches in sweeping America's black churches is the Christian Community Development Corporation. Civil rights leader John Perkins is widely credited as the grandfather of this movement, which began in one community in Mississippi. Perkins expanded the definition of the church as a place of worship to one as a force of complete spiritual and economic renewal. Pastor Kirby John Caldwell in Houston is one of the bright innovators who has led his congregation into a massive Christian community development project. A Wharton Business School graduate, Caldwell has been featured on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that described him as equally at ease in the pulpit as in the boardroom. Probably true. After a stint in business, Caldwell decided to go into the ministry and has led his Windsor Village Church from 25 members to close to 12,000 now in the past 16 years. But what he has done is applied his business acumen to the idea of building an entire community. He has turned his church into what he calls a lean, mean kingdom building machine. They have 120 ministries that reach out in the community with everything from job placement to financial planning, alcohol rehabilitation. He took over an abandoned Kmart and an auto supply store in southern Houston and is now turning into this hub of buzzing enterprises. They have there a bank, health clinic, a school, entrepreneurial suites that are essentially kind of to spawn new businesses, conference facility, pharmacy, a commercial kitchen, community college business, on and on and on. A variety of things that are taking place, including small businesses, which are spawned there and are then spun out as entrepreneurial standalones. The Power Center offers opportunities. They've created 275 new jobs in the community. And over the next few years, they're expected to add about $30 million to the local economy. Now, Kirby John was invited to introduce George W. Bush at the Republican convention, which he did, despite the fact that Kirby John Caldwell is a political independent. His being there rankled some in the black community, but his approach, I think, is an important bridge. There are scores of faith-based social entrepreneurs who are helping families transition from welfare to economic self-sufficiency. There are people who are now willing to come alongside a particular family and offer their time as a mentor. It matters. We're discovering that in the emphasis of getting people from welfare into a job, getting a job is much easier than keeping it. But there are churches that are now willing to accept the responsibility of taking time once a week for an hour to go and actually be a mentor, to help teach how to manage money, to help teach how to keep a job, how to essentially raise a family. And we're finding that as you harness the energy of these good-willed people who are willing to give an hour of their time, it's a life-changing endeavor for both those who are giving and those who are receiving. Dr. Amy Sherman has written significantly on this subject, and she's been traveling around the country basically teaching congregations how to do this kind of work. And is a part, I think, a key part of this welfare-to-work transition by actually mobilizing the faith community to help those who want to be helped. Interfaith Housing Coalition is a group in Dallas that I visited several years ago. They have been mobilizing teams of mentors all over the city to basically take homeless women who want to work and in the space of 3 months have transformed them from, you know, homeless people who would like to be in a productive position to women who have a job, who have saved $1,200 and have gotten their life together. First thing they do is a drug test. Well, guess what? 40% of them need to get the drug issue dealt with first. But for those who then come through after the detox and rehab program, if they are willing to stay in the program and are willing to go on the job search every day that they are asked to and willing to meet with their mentors to help them learn how to manage money, manage their time, head up a family, all of those who stay in the program, who complete it, all of them now have a job and are working. Only 70% of them have the gumption to stay in. Others leave for a variety of reasons. But for those who want to, they have a new life, and they're staying employed. One thing I think is important to point out here, this is, in a sense, the application of Chalmers' approach that I talked about earlier. It's dividing the whole task of caring for the poor into manageable portions of civic territory. In this case, it's the section of Dallas where they live. And the manageable portion of civic territory is one family that you personally help to mentor. It works. It works. It worked for Chalmers. It works for Ben Belzer in Dallas. It works for the families that Amy Sherman is helping to mentor around the country. And I think one of Belzer's comments is worth thinking about. He has turned down government money for his program, by the way. He also says, "I've learned while working with the poor that they don't want something for nothing. Their self-esteem grows when they give and when they work. No one has ever let them know the potential that they have." Now, here's one approach to helping people get on their feet. There is another approach to social entrepreneurship, which essentially takes the principles of business and uses them to produce social good. Coffee, Christianity, and capitalism are not three words you would usually link. It's an unlikely brew, one might say, but it's precisely the blend that John Sage and Chris Durnley came up to link a dot-com company in the U.S. to sell coffee to take care of street urchins and drug addicts in Costa Rica. How did this come about? These two guys were in Harvard Business School together, and they came up with the idea of packaging gourmet coffee beans from Costa Rica to essentially finance a ministry in Costa Rica. John Sage runs the marketing end from Seattle on the internet, and Chris Durnley has a rehabilitation center and a center for children in a rough neighborhood in San Jose. Now, here's an example of social entrepreneurship that harnesses the energy of the market to support a faith-based ministry that is helping the poor. Sage and Durnley got to be friends at Harvard when they graduated in 1989. Sage went to Microsoft, where he put in a lot of 80-hour weeks. Durnley, on the other hand, went to Costa Rica, initially in business, and ended up heading up this ministry. It turned out that he was, several years later, long on vision and short on cash. Sage, on the other hand, at 38, had more money than he could ever spend in the rest of his lifetime. What he needed was a purpose. Durnley had brought along a pound of coffee beans from Costa Rica as a gift. Sage had recently consulted on a charity project for Starbucks. So the two of them are drinking margaritas around the pool after a couple rounds of golf, thinking, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? And they came up with this idea, wait a minute, we could grow these coffee beans in Costa Rica. We could sell them on the internet. The marketing costs are fairly low. We can sell them for less than Starbucks does, and then we'll just plow the profits into finance your ministry. Voila, it's born. Now, Sage agreed to put up the capital, and he has been doing what he calls guerrilla marketing to sell the coffee beans from his office in Seattle via the internet. It's been a great success, and it's one small example of what two people with a brain and a vision can do to harness the fruits of the market to care for people, but in a voluntary way. Faith-based social entrepreneurs are on the front lines renewing our communities from the inside out. They are the intellectual and spiritual heirs of the colonials who helped because of their faith and who spawned the voluntary associations that Tocqueville admired later. Their track record is remarkable and their promise is great. Some forward-thinking businessmen are forming venture capital funds to fund social entrepreneurs privately. If business leaders are willing to look at the track record of these faith-based social entrepreneurs, they will find that they're able to leverage results with these wisely invested funds. Even if you don't agree with the premise of faith-based groups, the record would indicate that these social entrepreneurs really are changing people's lives for the better, and an investment in them is a solid investment in the community. It's an interesting phenomenon to witness high achievers in the marketplace who are reaching a point of, is that all there is? And embarking on a search for meaning. There's a growing group of high-level executives that I've encountered that are reaching what Bob Buford calls in his book by this title, halftime. Get halfway through your life and say, fine, I've achieved success, but what of that has any lasting significance? Buford's answer was, I'd like to take the fruits of my labor, and in his case, they're quite substantial, and put them to use to do something else that is truly significant, not just successful. Many of them are forming a human bridge between the business world and the social entrepreneurs on the front lines, doing the difficult job of scooping up broken lives and making them whole. I think if we could shift the discussion from the things that the government ought to be doing to those of what private voluntary associations are already doing, we could have a very compelling argument for how to care for our neighbors compassionately. This is the approach that can foster personal virtue, the personal virtue that made America great in its early years. It's a way to reconnect our communities at the grassroots and to revitalize the atrophied soul of the nation. Much of America is materially rich, but spiritually impoverished. If we receive blessings in this life and we do not pour them out on others, they and we become stagnant. The difference between the River Jordan and the Dead Sea is that while they are both fed by the same source, one has an outlet which keeps it fresh and capable of sustaining life. The other does not. It's an apt metaphor for our possible responses to the outpouring of the economy. In conclusion, Peter Kreeft writes in his book, Back to Virtue, anyone whose common sense has not been dulled by familiarity should be able to see the blindingly obvious truth that there is something radically wrong with a civilization in which millions devote their lives to pointless luxuries that do not even make them happy, while millions of others are starving. A civilization where no hand, voluntary or involuntary, moves money from luxury yachts to starving babies fast enough to save the babies. It does not take a moralist to see that something is not working. Peter Kleek concludes, the three theological virtues are a single plant. Faith is its root, hope its stalk, its life thrust. Love is its fruit. The plant is God's own faith in us. I suggest that what we need is not so much a change of policy as a change of heart. What we do as individuals in the private sector matters very much. Faith, hope, and charity are the hands that receive God.